I told Arisha no swearing in this one, but she refuses to listen.
It's August 1973, 6 weeks since Paul Getty was kidnapped, and most of Rome is on holiday. The piazzas are empty, the cafes are quiet. Even the Pope packed up and left town. But Fletcher Chase is still here, and he's frustrated. Every single day for almost 2 weeks straight, he's talked to every bohemian and flower child, dropout and druggie that Rome has to offer. And he's still no closer to finding Paul than when he arrived. J.P. Getty, Paul's grandfather, is waiting for answers. So far, Chase doesn't have any. He thought he was onto something when one of Paul's friends told him the kid racked up a mountain of debt with some sketchy drug dealers and had gotten himself into a jam.
Which would lend credence to the theory that Paul staged his own kidnapping to get money from his grandfather.
Right. Chase is starting to think maybe that's actually what happened. He even wonders if the boy's mother, Gail, is in on it too. But then he gets another tip from yet another friend that the kid's just out of town shooting a movie and will be back in Rome any day now. Back to square one. It's like each new lead cancels out the last new lead. Until now, he finally thinks he's onto something real. Around noon, Chase leaves his five-star hotel and makes his way across town to a big open square called Campo di Fiori. The sun beats down on him as he walks. Rome is in the middle of a record-setting heat wave, but Chase is used to the heat. After all, he ran John Paul Getty's security in Saudi Arabia. Chase reaches the square and scans the crowd. Eventually, a man approaches. He's compact and tough-looking. He says his name is Bruno, though Chase doesn't believe that for a second. But names aren't important. If Bruno's information checks out, then he can call himself whatever the hell he wants. Bruno says he's part of the gang that kidnapped Paul, and he knows where the boy's being kept. He can bring Chase there. For a price, of course. So Chase pulls out an envelope stuffed with $3,000 in cash. He hands it to Bruno with a warning. "I don't want to spend a whole day playing games with you." Bruno promises there won't be any funny business, just a drive to the country. 90 minutes later, they approach a hilltop town called Monte Cassino. It's a tiny village surrounded by olive and cypress trees, just the kind of place to hide from the world. They park the car and Bruno hops out to use the payphone. When he comes back, he tells Chase the good news. He just spoke to one of Paul's guards. The guy's going to bring Paul into town once it gets dark. All Chase has to do is wait for him at the local bar.
Hold up, Bruno's not staying?
He says he can't risk being seen with the crew. So he leaves Chase alone, standing in the street, watching the bar. An hour goes by, then two. The heat starts to fade a little. The sun dips below the hills, and still no sign of Paul.
This guy has the patience of a monk.
He probably picked it up at the CIA, but all the patience in the world can't help him this time. Because by the time it gets dark, it's clear Paul isn't going to show.
Damn, he got conned.
It seems like it. And finally, Chase gives up. He gets back in his car and drives down to Rome. So much for his big lead.
So much for his $3,000.
And you know what the worst part is? He's going to have to tell his boss. From Wondery, I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And this is Even the Rich. In our last episode, Paul Getty, the 16-year-old grandson of the world's richest man, was kidnapped off the streets of Rome. His grandfather released a statement to the press that he refuses to pay a single penny of ransom. That left his mother, Gail, alone to cope with the fallout for weeks, until JP sends in an ex-CIA fixer to help find her son. And well, he's making this worse.
So it's still up to his mother to figure out a way to save her boy.
Pretty much. This is episode 2, Gale Force. That's the champagne. It's been 5 weeks since Paul vanished into thin air, and Gale is pretty much at her wit's end, as you can imagine. She's tried calling her ex-husband Paul Getty Jr., but he's getting harder and harder to reach. When she does get him on the phone, he's pretty much useless. He's clearly on something, booze or drugs or who knows what. When Gail brings up the subject of the kidnapping, he'll say things like, "That rascal is probably off with his friends." And sometimes he just refuses to talk about it at all. It's like she's talking to someone on planet number 9. Not exactly reassuring when your kid has gone missing and you're not sure what to do.
True.
Gail hasn't exactly been treated kindly by the Italian press either. I mean, right from the start, they don't think she acts like a mother should. Or more precisely, they don't think she acts like an Italian mother would. And that's what they want. You know, a woman on her knees, wringing her hands, eyes turned to the sky, racked with grief.
Okay, first of all, my Italian mother would never let those assholes see her sweat.
The point was that Italians love dramatics. There even used to be a tradition where people got paid to cry at funerals. And by cry, I mean wail like a banshee and throw yourself over the casket kind of thing.
Do you think that's on LinkedIn?
Yeah, check real quick.
Okay.
This is not Gail. She's a third generation San Francisco socialite. Her father is a federal judge. Plus, she was married to a Getty for 8 years. And as we know, they're kind of like robots when it comes to emotion. It's their way of maintaining control. So yeah, her people do not do public grieving, and she's not about to start now. The way she sees it, she's pretty much the face of this thing, and she wants the press to take her seriously. So she's not about to go sobbing all over the place. She said, "I was damned if I was going to show my grief publicly, much less with a couple million newspaper readers." But now she feels like they are punishing her for refusing to play the typical mother role, and they're looking for someone to blame. Rumors continue to swirl that if the boy's faking it and has kidnapped himself, maybe the mother is in on it too. Add to all of this, she hasn't heard from the kidnappers in a few days, and she's getting desperate. So she calls her lawyer and they agree on a plan. It's time for Gail to talk to the press again. It's not like she wants to. In fact, she's kind of dreading it. But it's the only way she has to communicate with the kidnappers. She's going to appeal to them directly, ask them to call her and let her know her son is okay. But she doesn't want a press feeding frenzy. She wants something she can control. So they decide Gail will talk to one producer on Italian television. She'll make a statement and that's that. No further questions.
Why do I feel like this isn't going to go well?
Because it doesn't.
Okay.
Sometime in mid-August, the camera crew arrives at her apartment. Can I just say I've tried to find this tape everywhere. I even called a friend in Italy and it's not out there. But it's in Italian, so we wouldn't be able to understand it anyway.
Should we just get tickets and go?
Yes.
Find it ourselves.
Gail is fluent in Italian and she's practiced her statement several times. She's ready. But when Gail opens the door, it turns out the producer has brought along someone else, a reporter. She's like, "Wait, this isn't what we talked about. I'm out." But the producer puts his foot in the door. He promises her they'll just ask a few questions. Nice questions. Sensitive questions. Gail thinks about it. I mean, they kind of have her over a barrel. So she agrees.
Oh boy.
Yeah. A few minutes into the interview, with the lights shining in her face and the camera whirring away, the reporter looks her straight in the eye and says, "Signora, do you think your son is dead?"
No.
Yeah.
That's so TMZ. What does Gail do?
She faints. Up until now, she's been doing everything she can to hold it together, cling to hope, pushing away her fears. But there's a limit to how much she can take. I mean, this whole situation is pretty much a mother's worst nightmare. And with that, the interview is over. Can't exactly continue when the interviewee is out cold.
Good strategy.
Yeah, it's not terrible. After they leave, Gail crawls into bed for a couple days, praying something will happen to bring her boy home. And then, Cinquanta calls. Her gambit worked.
I'm thinking he must have felt bad, seeing a mother break down like that.
Yeah, because the first thing he tells her is not to worry. Her son is alive. But Gail wants proof. So he thinks for a minute, and then he's like, "Well, give me some questions only Paul would know. I'll ask him and then call you back." So she comes up with a list. Like, what is the picture on the door of your sister's bedroom? And what is the name of our next door neighbor's cat? Stuff like that.
Oh my God, I'm trying to remember if I even know the name of my neighbor's cat.
Well, good thing your life doesn't hang in the balance.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of pressure, I'm positive I wouldn't know. Actually, I'm positive. Did you like that?
No, I did not like that.
This is what happens when you tell the story.
Okay, well, let's get back on the rails.
Okay.
When Cinquanta calls back, he gives Gail all the right answers, which is a relief. At least she knows he's alive. Obviously, there's still a lot to figure out with the ransom money, which Gail still doesn't have. But it is the start of this weird relationship between Cinquanta and Gail. He starts calling her regularly. He's still calling Gail's lawyer, Giovanni, about money specifics. But he thinks that Gail is more motivated to end this thing, so he's also pressuring her. And for Gail, it's her only connection to Paul, and she starts to get curious about him. Like, what kind of person would take someone else's kid and put them through this torture? She starts asking him personal questions, like, does he have a wife or does he have children? He tells her he does, and so she asks him how a man with a family could be involved in something so cruel. And he tells her, Senora, it's a job like any other.
And she's like, bitch, try being a single mom.
But he's always quick to remind her the sooner they can nail down the money, the sooner this whole thing will be over. Like she doesn't know that already. And then he adds menacingly, some of my friends are becoming unpleasantly impatient. Meaning, Gail needs to get busy. While Gail's tearing her hair out trying to figure out what to do, Fletcher Chase is on the top floor of the luxurious Eden Hotel, looking out of the window at a big, beautiful park. He's still stewing about the lost cash and trying to regroup. The case has him baffled. Nothing about it makes any sense, and everything he's learned so far points to a setup. He can feel it in his gut, but he just can't seem to cut through all the bullshit. He knows he needs to report back to JP, bite the bullet and be up front. So he picks up the phone and dials. It's his first report back, and they talk for the better part of a day.
Do you think JP was just keeping him on the phone so he wasn't getting any more ransom calls? He's like, just keep talking.
It's not a terrible tactic.
It's not.
Chase shares the list of rumors, calls, and leads he's been chasing, and all the theories that are floating around. Like one of Paul's friends told Chase that Paul went to see a movie about a fake kidnapping three times the week he disappeared. Or, get this, a couple in Texas tell Chase they're holding Paul and to wire money ASAP. This is one of many fake ransom calls he gets. Of course, Chase doesn't believe any of them, but I imagine he has a good chuckle about it.
It's probably not as funny to JP. Everyone wants his money, and they're willing to do anything to get it.
They also talk about the hoax theory, that Paul faked his own kidnapping. Chase tells JP that the cops don't think it's a kidnapping, and he has his doubts too. After everything he's found out about Paul and his lifestyle, it's hard not to. I mean, he's broke and he sells jewelry on the streets. He goes to clubs where questionable characters hang out, clubs possibly owned by gangsters. And then there's this whole subset of rumors about Gail, that she's in on it because she's desperate for cash and that her current boyfriend is an underworld sleaze. Chase is told they like to hang out at the Luau Club, which is a tiki bar that's also well known as a mafia watering hole.
Can I just say, nothing gets me more excited for organized crime than a good old-fashioned Mai Tai. But I gotta say, I'm still not convinced Gail's in on it.
Maybe she's involved, maybe not. The only thing Chase knows for sure about Gail, she is a strong woman, a very strong woman. He writes that in his spy journal.
Risha, if he's a spy, it's just a journal.
But does she have the kind of strength it would take to pull off something like this for so long? Chase can't be sure. He's not sure of anything. But he is a big believer in conspiracies. I mean, he's an ex-spy. Now he's wondering if he's in the center of one himself. About the only thing he can be sure of since he's gotten to Rome is that everyone seems to be working an angle. JP doesn't say a whole lot. He asks questions here and there, but he's this measured guy who takes his time. I mean, he didn't get where he is making impulsive decisions and flying by the seat of his pants. But he's definitely listening. And when he does finally speak, he's firm on one point. He still isn't going to pay any ransom. When Chase hangs up, one thing is clear. He needs to get this situation under control. But that's not going to happen with Gail fielding phone calls from the kidnappers and talking to the press every time she starts to think about her kid. He needs to get her out of the middle of this, get her out of the country. But how? He needs some sort of plausible reason to convince her. And then they'll have to convince the world. And the plan Chase comes up with? Well, it's going to require a performance worthy of an Academy Award.
Ooh, I hope there's a dream sequence.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay, well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look, and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh yeah, the Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes.
When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss. Yeah. And so mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listed on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen, and you know I love my thrillers.
I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah, new members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500 to get started.
On a hot day in August, Gail and Chase meet up at her apartment to go over the plan. Chase wants Gail out of Italy so he can get control of the situation, start talking to the kidnappers himself. But first, he has to convince Gail, which is surprisingly easy. He tells her the phones are ringing off the hook with press calls. Maybe the kidnappers can't get through. If she leaves in a public way, the press will stop hounding her.
Yeah, the press are known for just giving up like that.
Gail is a little suspicious, but when Chase suggests she go to London, she thinks, great, maybe I can get my deadbeat ex to sit down and talk, straighten out the whole ransom thing and end this once and for all. Now they just need a ruse. It's not like Gail can just up and take a vacation. The press will crucify her, maybe even follow her. They need a foolproof operation, but Chase has already thought of that. Gail is going to be the mother the press has wanted to see from the start, if she can pull it off. Chase says, do you think you can fake a collapse? Can you fall down, cry, scream, whatever?
And she's like, no, I come from a family that buries their feelings so they get through the day. That's way out of my wheelhouse.
She says she'll try. One day later, the press is camped out on Gail's steps, per usual, and Gail's as nervous as an ingenue in her first starring role.
Opening night jitters. I've had those. Sometimes you gotta take a nervous poop and move on, though, am I right?
You are right. Gail takes a deep breath and reaches down to the depths of her soul. Then she walks to the window facing the street. Her son has been missing for more than a month. No one even believes he's been kidnapped. She feels so alone. She misses her baby. What if he never comes back? What if he's... And then she opens the window wide. As the tears start to flow, Gail collapses on the floor. And then she really gets herself going. Her crying turns into sobbing. I'm talking big time heaving sobs. You know, like the kind you do in fifth grade after Alex Kinn didn't circle yes in the note you left in his locker? Or that time your dog ran away and you were worried he would never come home?
Okay, hold on. Is this what Gail is thinking, or is this something that happened to you?
I mean, I'm getting carried away by her performance. It's called method acting, Brooke.
Okay.
But seriously, Gail's been keeping these feelings locked away for weeks, contained in a box she didn't dare open. And now the lid has popped and nothing can hold back the waterfall of tears. She's like having a total meltdown. But after a while, she's getting tired of crying. And there's still more to do. The most nuanced part of her performance. She opens the front door and makes her way feebly down the stairs, wiping her eyes. Then a car pulls up, all part of the plan, and a friend rushes out to help her get in. Once inside, she breathes a sigh of relief.
And now she's whisked away to London.
Not yet. A real nervous breakdown requires a trip to the hospital, which is where they go, and where more press are waiting. They're like, at last, our grieving mother. When she exits the car, she says, I've known this doctor for a long time.
Ooh, is this the dream sequence?
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
I mean, that makes more sense, honestly.
Well, she cries some more, too. She later says, by the time I got through with it, I believed it. I absolutely believed it because it was actually there. It was like this cathartic experience in a way.
I totally get that. I mean, she's been pushing all of this down for weeks. It probably felt good to just let loose for once.
And it works. After a brief stay at the hospital where doctors pump her full of meds, Chase sends her off to London, where he has arranged a safe house where Gail is supposed to stay. It's actually a pretty nice flat in Kensington, but no one is to know she's there. He tells her to lay low, no calls. He'll call her and let her know how it's going back at home. Gail's like, okay, but she figures it's okay to call family, right?
Ugh, Gail's going rogue.
The first call she makes is to Sutton Place, the estate of Paul's grandfather, JP. JP's longtime secretary answers the phone. Gail asks to be put through to the old man, and to her surprise, he picks up and he actually sounds happy to hear from her. He was always fond of Gail, but the call is short. He says, I hope you're all right. I just can't see you. I hope you understand. And the odd thing is, she does.
Wow, Gail's a saint. My Italian ass would jump through the phone and strangle that guy.
Yep. She actually feels sorry for him. He's 80, an old man. And she says that no old man's capable of dealing with this kind of thing. She doesn't want to be the one to put him in the grave.
This thing is complicated.
You're telling me. With JP refusing to help, Gail has to move on to plan B.
Ugh, the deadbeat ex.
Yep. She calls him and sets up a time to meet. But for the next 10 days, she tries to lay low. Mostly stays in the flat, except when Chase calls and wants to meet. In secret. They rendezvous at a park. It's very hush-hush and on the DL. Spy stuff.
Like a shoe that turns into a phone, or a phone that turns into a knife.
Wow, we're in another dream sequence. But yeah, something like that. Or at least that's how I picture it anyway.
Yeah, of course.
The first time they meet, Chase wants to give her some instructions. I'm imagining it's one of those classic, cool, gray London days. Gail sits on a park bench surrounded by rows of chestnuts and oak trees. When Chase arrives, he's wearing a trench coat and silently slips in next to her. They both stare straight ahead. Or maybe they're walking around and Chase keeps looking over his shoulder to see if they're being followed. And then he sets off some sort of smoke grenade and pulls Gil behind some bushes to hide.
And then a guy comes over the radio and says, Rabbit and Flamingo are behind the hedge.
Okay, so maybe it isn't that exciting. What we do know for sure is that on that first meeting with Gil, he tells her that Giovanni is no longer needed. Giovanni is the lawyer Gil hired to help handle the kidnappers' calls and to deal with the press. But now Chase tells her Giovanni's done his job. Chase will take it from here. If she wants to keep him on staff, she'll have to pay him herself. Mm. Which, Gail doesn't have any money. At least the kind of money where she can keep a lawyer on retainer. So Gail does as she's told. She writes him a letter and thanks him for everything he's done. And for all she knows, someone pays him off and he goes away. Chase tells her they'll keep Giovanni's office and his secretary in case the kidnappers call while Gail is away.
Gail must feel like such a pawn. Fake a nervous breakdown, fly to London, fire your lawyer, don't talk to the kidnappers.
Oh, it's worse than that. With Chase micromanaging every last detail, she's starting to worry he's going to mess everything up. It's late afternoon on August 23rd, and the sun is shining as Gail walks down a narrow street in London that looks over the River Thames. She rings the bell at 16 Cheyne Walk. It's a large brick Victorian surrounded by other large brick Victorians, all behind wrought iron gates. Oh, and Mick Jagger's house is a few doors down.
Oh, you mean the ex-husband of Jerry Hall, who is now married to Rupert Murdoch, who tormented Princess Diana in his tabloids? See? All of our stories are connected.
Yeah, but what about Beyonce?
She's too busy for their shit.
Gail is here to talk to her ex-husband, Paul Jr., about their son and how he needs to cough up their ransom money. Junior's secretary lets her in. She tells Gail that Junior is in the library and points her down this hallway. The house is a mess. Like the cleaning lady hasn't been here in a while. The windows are peeling and there's like an inch of dust on everything. Gail finds Junior in the library and he does not look well. He's thin and pale. He's laying back on the couch reading an auction catalog. There are books everywhere, like really old books. They spill out of the floor-to-ceiling built-ins. They're stacked on tables, on the carpet, against the wall. On one chair sits an ancient copy of the Canterbury Tales that's probably worth more than my apartment. There's also a half-empty bottle of rum on the floor and syringes on the coffee table. Oh, and a silver bowl that's filled with cream caramels.
Okay, I mean, except for the drugs and the books, you've just described my shelter in place. Those cream caramels always get stuck in my teeth.
Same. Most days, Junior doesn't even leave the house, except at 1 a.m. No one's exactly sure why, though.
The sugar high from those caramels is no joke, Arisha.
True. He's also been in mourning for like 2 years, ever since his last wife OD'd on heroin. There are still pictures of her all over the house. She's a gorgeous model named Talitha Holt, and he met her at a party thrown by Klaus von Bülow.
Wait, wasn't Klaus accused of marrying a rich lady and then poisoning her to inherit money?
Yep, that's him. Future episode for sure.
Yes.
Junior's basically living on rum, heroin, and regrets. And just like his dad, he's become a semi-recluse. Other than drugs, his only interest seems to be his growing collection of books, which at this point is worth at least $1 million.
So he's not exactly broke. He's living next to Mick Jagger and spending money on 2,000-year-old books.
Right, which is why Gail is here. She needs money and help. When Paul finally looks up, she's like, "We have to talk about our son and the kidnapping." He seems pleased to see her, but he wants to talk about anything but. Gail tries, but there's just no way getting through to him. And then, in the middle of their reunion, Junior's girlfriend waltzes in. Her name is Victoria Brooke, and she and Gail have met, but that's about it. Victoria gives Gail a hug anyway and says, "You poor, poor dear. The news. So terrible."
File that under what not to say to a mother whose son has been kidnapped.
Gail mumbles a thank you, and then Victoria says, "I'm so sorry, but we have guests arriving soon. Would you mind leaving?" And pushes her toward the door with promises they'll get together soon. By the time Gail is outside Junior's house, the sun has almost set, and once again, she's alone.
My God, this family is really effed up.
Even the rich. Gail goes back to Junior's house a few more times, hoping to catch him on a day when they can have a real conversation about what to do. But it's like hitting her head against a stone wall. The final straw is when she brings the kids over.
What kids?
Oh, did I forget to mention that Paul isn't Gail's only child?
Yeah.
She and Junior had a few other kids together, and Gail brought them to London. So she takes the kids over to Junior's, and he says, "How dare you bring uninvited people?" At that point, she's ready to jump over the piles of books and wring his neck. That's when she realizes there's no way to have any type of relationship with Junior as far as the kidnapping goes. She'll need to find another way to get the money.
We all face stress in our daily lives. What if the answer to a better stress response is in one key nutrient? I'm talking about magnesium, and specifically Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. This one-of-a-kind product is designed to reverse low levels of magnesium, which could have a positive effect on our stress response. But don't take my word for it. Here's a quote from a 2020 issue of the scientific journal Nutrients. "Results suggest that stress could increase magnesium loss, causing a deficiency. And in turn, magnesium deficiency could enhance the body's susceptibility to stress, resulting in a magnesium and stress vicious circle. I only recommend Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. It's the only organic full-spectrum magnesium supplement that includes 7 unique forms of magnesium for stress resilience and better sleep. Simply go to bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10, to get your Magnesium Breakthrough and find out this month's gift with purchase. That's bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10.
Life is busier than ever. It might be harder to find time these days to grocery shop, prep, and cook healthy and hearty meals. I get it. But Factor's got you covered.
Yeah, so Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, delivered right to your door, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes.
Exactly. And Factor is tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. If you're traveling or still finishing up last week's meals, you can always pause or reschedule deliveries.
I mean, I know I've talked before about how much I love Factor because it's just so easy.
And it doesn't taste like, you know, the microwavable meals you see, especially in rom-coms when we're trying to heighten and highlight how sad and pathetic this woman's life is.
Yeah.
They don't taste like that. They taste so good as if you made them yourself or hired a chef. Head to factormeals.com/rich50 and use code rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box. That's code rich50 at factormeals.com/rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mama, mama,
While Gail is spinning her wheels, Chase is back in Rome, assuming command of the operation. Now when the kidnappers call, he answers the phone. But what can he say? Even a Harvard man like Chase can't learn Italian overnight. So he brings the lawyer Giovanni back onto his payroll. Not only does Giovanni actually speak Italian, the kidnappers have dealt with him already. They're comfortable with him. But just because Chase is keeping him around doesn't mean they're equals in this thing. Giovanni is only Chase's translator and his reluctant roommate, since Chase is still camped out in Giovanni's office at this point. Chase knows the kidnappers have been erratic. They asked for millions one day and a few thousand the next. So he's going to make them an offer they can't refuse. In early September, when the kidnappers call, Chase is ready. He tells them the family is ready to make a deal on one condition. There must be a simultaneous exchange. That's spy talk for you'll get the money at the same time we get Paul.
Okay, very James Bond. But hold on a second, I'm confused. Isn't Gail in London trying to get money from Junior at this point?
She is. And as far as we know, she doesn't know about this plan. Not yet, anyway. But what's more interesting here is the conversation Chase has with JP, where JP tells him to go ahead and negotiate. He still won't pay a penny for their ransom, but he agrees to pay their expenses. In his mind, footing the bill for the kidnappers' expenses doesn't count as ransom.
Wait, what are their expenses? Cognac and pasta?
And blindfolds and duct tape.
A starter pack.
And all the guys who have been guarding Paul for weeks. I haven't been able to find out the exact amount. It's somewhere between $600 and $500,000.
That is an insane range.
And it will only happen if they can work out all the details. Like, how is this going to go down? Chase suggests putting the money in his trunk, and then the kidnappers put Paul in theirs, and then they'll just swap cars. The kidnappers have to think it over. When they call him back, they're like, no grazie, except not as polite. So Chase tries again. Okay, how about you and Paul are on one side of a bridge and me and the money are on the other? We meet in the middle of the bridge. His secret plan is to wait for the exchange and then shoot the kidnappers before they can get away. And finally, in the middle of this, Chase calls Gail to fill her in on the exciting developments. They're close. Gail freaks. His harebrained schemes are going to get Paul killed. She pleads with him to let the kidnappers set the terms. They have my son. They have what we want. And Chase is like, we have what they want. But as it turns out, Chase doesn't have what anybody wants. The kidnappers reject all of his offers. So he's right back where he started, at the beginning.
I guess Chase is finding out being the boss isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Meanwhile, Gail, who's still in London, is now worried sick. She has no idea what Chase is telling the kidnappers. She wants reassurance he didn't completely screw things up. She's like, what am I doing here? I'm paralyzed. Then one night, when having dinner with friends, she has a real nervous breakdown, like sobbing in the bathroom for 30 straight minutes. When she's done, she decides she's played nice long enough. She calls a friend to wire her airfare, and within a few days, she's on a plane heading home, back to Rome. She touches down the first week of September and heads back to her apartment. It feels good. Well, not exactly good, but at least she's closer to the action where she can actually do something. She's closer to Paul. And then, guess who?
Cinquanta.
Si, signora. He tells her he's glad she's back. Or at least I imagine that's what he said, because Italians are very polite.
Yes, we are.
You are definitely the exception to that.
Wow.
And then he tells her why he's calling. He doesn't trust Chase. He doesn't believe Chase has the boy's interest at heart. But he knows Gail does. She's his mother, after all. And then he wants to know what happened in London. Where is the money?
So much for small talk.
Gail explains Paul Jr. didn't come through. Cinquanta isn't happy. He doesn't understand how such a rich family could care so little about Paul's life. And suddenly she finds herself telling him about Junior's issues, his health problems, his emotional problems. She even tells him about Junior's dead wife. And Cinquanta asks, why haven't you told me about your family before? But what can she say? She's married into the richest family in the world. You don't air out your dirty laundry to just anyone without building some trust, especially if that person kidnapped your son and might use it against you. Cinquanta explains they've been patient, but their patience is growing thin. It's been almost 2 months now without movement forward. He tells her about a meeting where the group voted on whether to kill Paul.
Oh my God.
He assures her he voted no, but he says many voted yes. He can't hold them off much longer. And that's just the first of many calls. He starts to call her almost every day. It's a weird relationship. It's like Gail comes to trust him. She thinks they're in the same boat. They both want this over. They even have yelling matches like old married lovers. Gail believes this whole thing is taking a toll on Chinquanta too. And she actually starts to feel sorry for him.
This is getting weirder by the minute.
Oh, yeah. And that's nothing compared to the weird calls that keep coming in. More people claiming they have Paul or know where he is. A group in Paraguay sends a letter in Spanish. A girl in Texas wants Gail to fly her sister to Italy and give her a home in exchange for information. A kid in America turns up at church with amnesia. Could he be the one? Gail doesn't believe any of them. She's sticking with the horse she rode in on. And that's Chinquanta, who is now completely losing patience. He's tried to be understanding, but he's tired of all the excuses. And one day when he calls her, he lets her have it.
You wish to play with your son's life, señora. You have wasted valuable time.
She's as frustrated as he is. She tells him she's not in charge of the money and the people who are won't listen to her. But Chinquanta has had it. He tells her he doesn't trust her anymore and he can't hold off the others.
Translation, Paul is a goner.
Which is the thing Gail is most worried about. If anyone understood this is a ticking time bomb, it's her. All she can do is plead once more for her son's life. She tells Chinquanta, what am I supposed to do? I can't even get them to believe this whole thing is real. And that's when Chinquanta says he wants to meet in person. He says,
Senora, you must come to talk to us yourself. We will deal with this together. You will be able to see your son and I will guarantee your safety.
He has it all figured out. She needs to follow his detailed instructions. She must come alone and she cannot be followed. And if she breaks the rules, then her baby boy is going to suffer.
But it sounds like she doesn't have a choice, right? I mean, he's laying down the gauntlet. If you don't do this, we hurt the kid.
Right. And if she doesn't do it exactly the right way, they hurt him too. But what if they kidnap her too, and then they have both of them? She needs time to think, so she asks Chinquanta for time. He gives her one day.
That must have been one sleepless night.
I know. But she makes a decision. When she calls Chinquanta back, she tells him she's in.
Wow.
Now come the instructions. Like, they're so precise, they're almost ridiculous. She has to drive a particular car that has a bumper sticker on the back and a white suitcase on the roof rack. He tells her how far she has to drive to a point south of Naples and that a man will be waiting, but she has to time it just right. She'll know it's him because he'll throw gravel at the windshield.
Oh my God, I hope that car isn't a rental.
Seriously. Gail agrees to it all, and Chinquanta tells her he's sticking his neck out for her, so she'd better show up. But Gail has no reason not to. For the first time, she feels like she's finally doing something that might free her son. She's making progress. But then she thinks, maybe I should tell someone about this. I mean, if she disappears, no one will know what happened. So she calls her dad. When she tells him about the plan, he's like, no, are you nuts? These are kidnappers. What if they take you two and kill you both? Gail decides she needs a second opinion, so...
she calls JP.
Next best thing. She calls Chase, and he loses his shit. There's no way she's doing this.
Apparently, these guys have never heard of mothers flipping a car to save their child.
Seriously. But now Gail is totally conflicted. She gave Chinquanta her word. What will he do to Paul if she doesn't show up? In the end, the pressure on Gail is too much. On the day she's supposed to go, she backs out.
Good move.
But she has no way of calling Chinquanta to let him know. It's not like he gave her his phone number. So he only finds out when she doesn't show up. And naturally, he's pissed. He calls her in a rage. He's always been polite on the phone, but now he drops the buddy-buddy act and says something that stops her heart. He says,
I have done my best to protect your son. Whatever happens now is not my responsibility.
Gail realizes she's made a terrible mistake. Maybe the biggest mistake of her life.
Oh, man. And something tells me Paul is going to have to pay for the screw-up.
Imagine you're in a rural part of southern Italy.
Like Under the Tuscan Sun? I love that movie.
Yeah, no. Wrong movie. There aren't any vineyards here. Just a beat-up stone house on an isolated stretch of farmland and some of Paul's captors standing out front speaking Italian. Inside, Paul Getty is scared out of his mind, even though he knows things could probably be worse. Because they have been. He's starting to lose track of time. getting a little screwy in the head as endless days turn into endless nights, he starts collecting his own fingernails and keeps them in a matchbox.
It's important to have hobbies.
He reads the same magazines over and over, staring at the faces in the ads. He wants to remember expressions, smiles, eyes, happy. He sleeps a lot too, but at least he has a bedroom and it's clean. Most of the guards are polite. He gets regular meals. He even has a radio so he can hear updates from the outside world and stories about how everyone thinks he's faking the whole kidnapping thing. But that's taken away the day Gail misses her appointment with Chinquanta and the kidnappers. He's taken out of the hut and blindfolded and then walked up a hill to another hut, a hut they built specifically for him. Inside are four stakes. They chain him to one and they keep him there for days. He starts having these crying spells. There's nothing to look forward to except endless days rolling together. He keeps track of time by scratching days on a rock. He thinks it's the only record that he was here and once alive. Then one day a guard runs in. He's new. Paul hasn't seen him before. He's jittery, nervous, like he's not in control. His mask even slips a little and he yells at Paul, "Did you see my face?" Paul's like, "No." He's been trained not to look directly at any of the kidnappers. But the guard doesn't believe him. He says, "Now I'm going to kill you." He tells Paul to get up and takes off his chain. Then he walks him away from the hut to a secluded spot near the creek, and he says, "Start running."
I don't want to hear this. From Wondery, this is episode 2 of our 4-part series.
What are you doing?
I don't want to hear what they're going to do to that poor kid. I just want this story to be over.
Okay, hold on. We're not done.
Okay, fine.
"Start running," he says. And then he yells it again. At this point, Paul is shaking. He's trying to think. And finally he says, "Can I have a cigarette?" Which kind of throws the guy off his game. He considers it a moment and then says yes. And that's when Paul realizes the guy is scared too. They just stare at each other for a long time while Paul puffs as slow as he can and considers. There's nothing more dangerous than someone with a gun who is scared. And for the 500th time since this whole thing started, he hopes someone is coming.
Oh my God, Arisha, please tell me JP is gonna come through.
Next time.
From Wondery, this is episode 2 of 4 of The Kidnapping of Paul Getty. We use many sources when researching our stories, like Vanity Fair, The New York Times, and Rolling Stone. But we especially recommend 3 books: All the Money in the World by John Pearson, The House of Getty by Russell Miller, and Kidnapped by Charles Fox.
I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And I'm Brooke Sifrin. Elizabeth Kosen wrote this episode. Our editor is Lordana Pellavoda. Caleb Bissinger is our associate producer. Sound design by James Morgan. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Marsha Louie, and Hernan Lopez. For Wondery.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.